From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, August 17th through Friday, August 21st, it was a week during which many subjects were dissected, numerous speeches were delivered, and multiple stories were told, as two views of America were sold through the binary lenses of competing realities. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Unless, of course, we mail it in, thus casting the straws that break the snail's back. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing from a variety of talk media personalities, grassroots pundits, contemplators, and opinion influencers, checking in from Atlantic City, Denver, Seattle, Brooklyn, New England, Jupiter, and Kalamazoo. People with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation, all part of the verbal stew, in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, let's talk. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the California wildfires and climate change. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes in regions around the San Francisco Bay Area as wildfires blazed across the state during a blistering heat wave that is now in its second week.
The combination of the wildfires, the heat wave, and discussion of the topic at the Democratic National Convention brought the subject of climate change back into the national conversation.
At number 9, Stephen K. Bannon arrested for fraud. In a shocking news story that broke on Thursday, the former Trump administration advisor was arrested while sailing in a luxurious yacht owned by a Chinese billionaire off the coast of Connecticut.
He's charged with embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars from donors in a fake $25 million We Build the Wall scheme and could be facing years in prison if convicted. He pleaded not guilty to the charges.
At number 8, U.S. relations with China, Russia, and the Middle East. While tensions between the U.S. and China continue to escalate week by week on a variety of fronts, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a bipartisan report on Tuesday explaining how Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election in favor of the Trump campaign, going beyond the findings of last year's Mueller report.
Meantime, the president has been receiving widespread praise for the role he played in bringing about a diplomatic agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, except from the Palestinians, who feel they've been sidelined in the process and betrayed by everyone involved.
At number 7, the Black Lives Matter movement, race relations, and political correctness. Discussion about the national reckoning on race was elevated this week by a number of speeches at the Democratic National Convention, as well as controversy erupting in the wake of municipal budget cuts affecting police departments across America.
Meantime, radio talk show hosts, their guests, and callers continue to decry the wave of political correctness that is stifling the free flow of ideas and conversation about a number of sensitive topics, such as race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation, while others continue to step in it while making inappropriate comments. For example, a Major League Baseball play-by-play announcer was pulled off the air in the middle of a game for uttering a slur offensive to the LGBTQ community, not realizing that his mic was open.
At number 6, the nation's economic struggles. Although Wall Street keeps rolling along, seemingly unscathed, Main Street is clearly suffering. New unemployment claims bounced back up above 1 million this past week, and a cross-section of businesses in all sectors of the nation either remain closed or are teetering on the brink of failure because of lack of traffic and spending.
Meantime, congressional talks on the details of a second stimulus package remain stalled, although both parties claim they want to come to some kind of agreement that'll help Americans cope with their loss of income due to the devastating effect the coronavirus is having on the economy.
At number five, the nation's educational struggles. As September looms closer and some school districts have already officially started the fall semester, returning to some sort of normalcy remains extremely problematic.
Although children are widely thought to be at relatively low risk of developing severe COVID-19, a new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics indicates that cumulative cases doubled in roughly the past month. It's feared that reopening schools might accelerate the increase, potentially raising the number of children with severe symptoms and spurring spread among the community at large. On the other hand, remote learning has proven to be wrought with problems, not to mention the emotional toll this is taking on children, parents, and teachers is nothing short of alarming.
At number four this week, healthcare, meds, and vaccines. Controversy over hydroxychloroquine and other therapeutics remain hot radio talk show topics, both medically and politically.
And the race to develop a safe and effective vaccine, with speculation abounding over if and when it will arrive and be efficiently distributed, remains a central healthcare issue in the national conversation.
At number three, COVID-19 stats and projections. At the time this program is being produced on Friday, the number of diagnosed COVID-19 cases in the United States has risen to 5,746,534.
And the grim death toll has risen to 177,438. There have also been 3,095,910 recoveries, although the long-term negative effects on the body's organs have yet to be understood and determined.
At number two this week, the United States Postal Service debate. The debate over the USPS's ability to handle the enormous amount of processing and strain mail-in balloting would put upon its systems was a hot issue on news talk radio and TV shows across the nation. Republicans and conservatives are saying it'll create a situation that is ripe for voter fraud that would favor Biden and Democrats, and liberals are saying that the president wants to dismantle the post office to ensure himself a victory by suppressing the liberal vote.
And it came to a dramatic climax on Friday with the scheduled testimony of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy before the Senate Homeland Security Committee.
And at number one this week, the presidential race and the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were officially nominated at the first virtual national convention of a political party, and as expected, political talk show hosts on radio and television presented entirely different takes on the event, as though they and their audiences were living in completely separate universes.
And opinions on the format itself were broken down by party lines as well. It was either an inspirational and intimate event, or, as one conservative talk show host states, it was like a boring Zoom meeting. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's head out to Denver and touch base with the Talkers Heavy 100 radio host, heard noon to 3 daily on KOA in Denver, Mandy Connell. Mandy, you're a conservative woman on the radio. Wednesday night, the Democratic National Convention was devoted mostly to women. What was your reaction to that, as well as the convention in general?
I have to tell you, and this is not even a knock on the content at all, I think that this format is terrible. Absolutely terrible. It comes across like a really long, boring Zoom meeting. And that's really unfortunate because these things should be exciting. You know, even if I disagree with someone's political positions, I still want to kind of get sucked into the drama that surrounds all these things. And it's completely gone. And there's nothing the Democrats, I think, could have done to change that. It's just such an odd situation. So I'll be perfectly honest. I didn't watch last night, but I got up this morning and I watched speeches. And I have to say, Kamala Harris and I don't agree on anything politically, but I thought she did a really good job with her speech. She introduced herself to people who have probably not paid attention to her at all and did so in a really, really strong way. And I thought she came across very strong last night and really kind of set the tone for who I think she wants to be on this campaign. And I think she did a good job.
And what are your thoughts and feelings about a woman running for vice president, or women running for either the presidency or the vice presidency?
I would lie if I said I wasn't. There wasn't a secret thrill in 2008 being able to vote for a woman on the McCain-Palin ticket. I was not a fan of the ticket for various reasons, but it was exciting to be able to pull the lever for someone who marks the same gender box. But I had absolutely no thought ever of voting for Hillary because policy-wise, I thought everything she wants to do is wrong. And policy-wise, I think everything Joe Biden and Kamala Harris want to do is wrong. So from that perspective, it's not going to have any role in who I vote for. And I'm not conflicted by that because ultimately I look at issues from one perspective and it's, okay, does this give me more freedom in my life to pursue my life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Yes or no? And that's not a gender question for me. That's just a humanity question for me. So I know what it's like to be able to pull the lever for someone who looks like you, and it's fun. And I think white men really don't understand that sometimes. They kind of get lost because they've always had that option, you know? So there is something there to the emotional aspect of it, but does it trump what I believe in? No, not even
how about from a media standpoint, what do you think the Republicans are going to do now that the Democrats had the first go at it? And that had to be a daunting task to pull off this convention
I got to tell you, Michael, I said this on my show a couple days ago, that I would hate to be the person trying to figure out how to make the RNC not like the DNC, just from a production value standpoint, because this is so challenging and there's not a great answer. And I think what might be better in my world is if you put even if you gave them a wall of televisions, would make it like a real Zoom call where you can see people's reactions and integrate some of that stuff, those reactions into what's going on. Anything's got to be better than political speeches dry with no applause lines, there's just no interaction. It's hard. It's too hard, I think.
At the end of Kamala Harris's speech, she turned to a wall of Zoom, and there were, 30, 40, I couldn't count them all, women applauding her. And it was interesting. It reminded me of watching the World Wrestling Entertainment dealing in a situation that's feigning audience where there is none, or watching Major League Baseball with a piped in sound. So I definitely find, as a media theorist and a student of media, and you're one too, that it's interesting just on that level, isn't it?
Well, I said on my show that, anyone who works in talk radio is essentially like a crazy person. We sit in a room by ourselves, talking to ourselves, right? That's what our job is. I could easily do this because I'm not ever expecting any kind of feedback. But for someone who's been out on the political stump or is used to that feedback, it's really hard. And I think we've seen that. And again, I'm not saying that this is a failure of the Democrats. What they're trying to do is extremely difficult with nothing to play off of. It just changes the dynamics so much.
That's radio talk show host Mandy Connell of KOA in Denver. That's the sister station of our affiliate in the Mile High City, Freedom 93.7. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's pivot now to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and a visit with the morning host on radio station WKZO in Kalamazoo, Ken Lanphier. Ken, were you folks disappointed that your governor, Gretchen Whitmer, didn't get the vice presidential nod?
No, I didn't really sense any real disappointment that Gretchen Whitmer didn't get the nod. She's obviously been very involved in issues here in the state of Michigan, particularly in COVID-19. She's been very upfront with the people of Michigan about how she expects things to go, and pushing wearing masks and reminding everybody on a weekly basis through press briefings that we still need to continue to be vigilant against this. So I think people were very flattered that they were talking in terms of Gretchen Whitmer being on the national ticket. I don't think there was a great deal of disappointment. We're pretty pleased overall. I think she gets good reviews as the governor here in the state of Michigan.
How's Kalamazoo holding up?
Well, we're doing pretty well as far as the rest of the state of Michigan. We're one of the positive stars, I guess you could say. We got some word yesterday from the state health director that our cases are leveling off here in the Kalamazoo area. Can't necessarily say the same thing for some other parts of the state, but overall we're doing very well, and we're very pleased about that.
Is the issue of opening schools a hot and heavily contested one in your area?
Very much so. Kalamazoo Public Schools has announced an ambitious plan to have the school year start remotely. A number of districts in West Michigan are going to try to bring their students in for the first part of the school year anyway, and a number of districts have gone to what they consider a hybrid, where parents will have the choice to either start their students in school with teachers with face-to-face learning, or do it online. But a couple of schools have gone back and forth on this here in our area, trying out the hybrid and then changing their mind and going all virtual. But it has been a topic at the top of the news, and still a lot of controversy about how we're going to get this school year started, how safe we're going to be once we get the school year going. And that's going to start here in Michigan by the first of next week for a lot of districts.
That's Ken Lanphier, morning host at WKZO in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Coming up next, a conversation with Michael Medved. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We are at war with a murderous enemy for control of the planet. Bugs. Some you can see and others you can't. Bed bugs and other insects, as well as viruses and bacteria. Since 1967, a product known to the medical supplies and hospitality industries has been heavy artillery in the war against bugs, viruses, and bacteria. It's called SteriFab. Beware of scam products in the market making all kinds of promises. SteriFab is the only product registered with the EPA that kills insects and disinfects microbes. Many states require it to be applied prior to the rental of hospital beds and wheelchairs, as well as secondhand mattresses and furniture. You won't find SteriFab at the stores. It's usually sold in bulk for industrial use. But now, you can get SteriFab in convenient gallon or handy pint containers with spray nozzles by going to killsanddisinfects.com. Heck of a product. killsanddisinfects.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. Joining us is a Seattle-based radio talk show host heard daily at KTTH, as well as across the nation on the CRN Digital Talk Radio Network. Talkers Heavy 100 member, Michael Medved. Now, you've had your own issues being a conservative in today's highly polarized environment, where a lot of people are confused about the difference between being a conservative or being a dye-in-the-wool Trump loyalist. And I personally think the conservative movement in America is going to eventually have to come to grips, either now or 4 years from now or somewhere in between, with the difference between the conservative movement and Trumpism. What's going on in terms of your dealing with that in your radio
career? It's very difficult, because every election ends up being a choice. And I am trying to speak fully and fairly about both sides in this election, and both sides have lots of problems with them. I mean, the strongest argument against President Trump, and it's one that the Democrats haven't really gotten around to making, is do we really want 4 more years of this? And I know that my friends who are very loyal and devoted Trumpers say, well, look, what about all the great achievements? And the truth of the matter is, given the kind of work that we do, I think that the demeaning of our political discourse, the whole sort of hollowing out of the vital center, that whole inability of people to work together, the idea that your opponent is not just your opponent, but he's a Satan-worshipping, pedophilic cannibal. That's very unfortunate. And our nation really does need to turn away from that. Now, that may happen under a second term of President Trump, but I think it's probably somewhat more likely, though hardly a sure thing, that it would probably head that direction under President Biden.
It would head in what direction? I don't understand. Exactly.
In the direction of moving away from this sick polarization that we're experiencing now, where you're either all one or all the other. I guess I'd like to affirm the idea that I'm non-binary. But in my personal life, very binary and a proud father and grandfather. But in terms of politically non-binary, I think we need more of that.
Well, I mean, this week's and for the time stamping on this, we're conducting this conversation toward the tail end of the Democratic National Convention, which is not only fascinating politically, but it's really fascinating to me as a student of media, finding just that a convention now has gone through this remarkable evolution forced by the COVID-19. And I'm sure you also find it that. But I tend to think that Biden will sort of move to the center, as most presidents do, in spite of the fact that the Republicans are painting him as a puppet of the far left and the AOCs are going to drag him to the left. When you become president, you're the man or the woman. You know, there's something about the office that counterbalances all of the people that'll be pulling your strings. So I just find Trump to be a complete anomaly in terms of that syndrome of you campaign to the extremes for the primary, you sort of come to the center during the general election, and then you govern from the center. That's what I suspect. Trump doesn't do that. He has a whole different angle on how to leverage his base within the electoral college system. And he doesn't waver from it at all, does he?
Well, this is one of the things that people admire about him, is Trump's admirers and strong supporters will say, well, look, he's kept all his promises. He hasn't moved to the center. And the truth of the matter is he hasn't kept all his promises. He promised to replace Obamacare. And the progress in healthcare has been nil. He promised to fix a broken immigration system, and I think every fair-minded person can concede that our immigration system is a mess. It's broken. He hasn't done that, and no, he hasn't really built a border wall, and no, Mexico hasn't paid for it, and a great deal of. What you see from Trump, it's not so much fulfilling a well-defined agenda as it is, it seems to me, almost impulsively going in a direction that his base will strongly applaud. The question here is, he won last time with 46% of the vote. And I think his biggest challenge, because 46% of the vote won't win this time. There are no significant third and fourth party candidates. Last time, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein combined, that's the Libertarian candidate and the Green Party candidate, got 6%. And there's no chance in the world that either candidate, if either Biden or Trump gets 46% again, which is what Trump got last time, they will lose. And really, this is one of those elections where it's going to be almost impossible to assemble an electoral college majority unless you're over 50% in the popular vote. And we'll see. I mean, it's one of those things that if Trump doesn't make at least some concession to the idea of unifying the country and tamping down the polarization at his convention, I think he's going to have a very tough time. And one of the things I was thinking about, Michael, was that, okay, it's easy to ridicule the former Republicans who spoke for Biden at the Democratic convention, John Kasich and Colin Powell, it's no surprise, and Christine Todd Whitman. And then they had Cindy McCain's voice in that video. You ridicule them all you want. what I was wondering about is who are the former Democrats who are going to be there standing up for Trump at the Republican convention? There probably will be some, but I don't know who they are.
So what do you think about the post office flap?
Thank God we seem to have survived this crisis. I think the entire thing was just why I think a lot of Americans have a certain amount of contempt for both sides. No, President Trump was not about to undermine our democracy by interfering with the post office. And the Postmaster General, DeJoy, has now made it clear that, okay, we're not going to do any more cuts. We're not going to interfere. We'll be able to deliver all the mail-in ballots. And I also believe that we need a post office, and it should continue. And I think it is a political folly to on either side to try to make the post office a partisan issue.
Everything today is a partisan issue, so why not the post office?
Speaking about the post office and this whole conspiracy theory that Trump is trying to destroy the post office, one of the reasons I don't take that too seriously, or not seriously at all, frankly, is because as a Republican for 40 years, and I literally have been a Republican for 40 years, I changed my registration to support President Reagan. I get literally twice a day some kind of solicitation from the Trump campaign or the Republican National Committee. And guess what? It's not online. It's in the mail.
That's KTTH Seattle talk show host Michael Medved, also heard across America on the CRN Digital Talk Radio Network. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We live in complex times when it comes to race relations and justice and hate at home and abroad. Whether it's the reckoning between white and black being driven by the Black Lives Matter movement, or the never-ending strife between the Israelis and Palestinians exacerbated by the peace treaty between Israel and the UAE spearheaded by President Trump. Political correctness, the cancel culture, and campus closed-mindedness remain big topics in the national conversation. We're joined by Kenneth S. Stern, the director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate in New York, and he's a best-selling author. As an attorney and expert on anti-Semitism, he's argued before the Supreme Court of the United States and testified before Congress. His newest book is titled The Conflict Over the Conflict, The Israel-Palestine Campus Debate. Ken, you have a worldwide reputation for being an expert on hate. So what would you say is the level of hate today in 2020 compared to other times in the world?
I think it's still an open question. I mean, Black Lives Matter and the murder of George Floyd and the outpouring of concern about it in the aftermath, I think are all positive things. These are important questions for our society about race and discrimination and so forth, and what do we do about it going forward? If we get into, again, the sort of us versus them manifestation on either side of it, it can make matters worse. If the question becomes, how do we as a society make it so that nobody is discriminated against and work towards that goal, and we're all equally part of the fabric of America, that could be a positive thing. But I think we're seeing both trends, and which one's going to win out is going to be hard to say.
Now, the other major issue, and this ties right into your, to use a term, wheelhouse, you have a book out called The Conflict Over the Conflict, which is a deep dive into the complexities surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is back in the news since last week's peace accord brokered by the president between Israel and the UAE, and that's angered the Palestinians.
Well, it's a large question, and it's unclear, again, how it's going to play out. I think it's a positive thing to have peace and other countries making peace with Israel, but there's also the question of the internal politics in each of these countries and what it plays to. And the question for the Palestinians, if you put yourself in their perspective, is they were sort of sidelined on this. Whether that's, how much of it is their fault or other people's fault, you could sort of understand their point of view. So again, it's a complicated situation with not all justice on one side or another. But it reflects some deeply held positions. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that each side seems to ascribe justice in its totality to their side and the other side is evil. One is, if you look at the histories and the competing narratives, it's inherently complex. And if you embrace the complexity, you can understand better ways forward. When you see justice on one side and not on the other at all, that's a problem.
Now, just in everyday life, I've been to Israel a number of times. And what you see on the street are Israelis and Palestinians getting along, working together, living together, cooperating, that you don't see hostility between individual people in every frame of reference. And the same thing I could say in my view of America. You don't see white and black people hostile to each other when you look around. You see them working together. You see them living near each other or together, intermarriage. Is there a disconnect between what most people are like in each of these two situations and maybe governments or maybe radical fringes and just the way everyday life is? Are these conflicts being controlled by forces other than the people?
Well, certainly you're right that people do get along on a day-to-day basis and have identities and shared values over jobs and politics and culture and sports and a whole bunch of other things. But there are some fundamental differences between looking internally in the United States about race relations. Well, the question is, everybody is seen as part of the same fabric. And you have two competing national narratives in Israel, among the Israelis and the Palestinians. So that's a more complex thing, because Palestinians have a perspective where beyond their allegiance to Israel, there's also a Palestinian narrative and a desire on their own part to have self-determination. So they're not exactly the same thing. But you're right, in the sense that people do get along, and then there are ideologies and identities that sometimes can make it more difficult for people to get along or to get to a point where the system is set up where they have a better chance of getting along.
That's attorney Kenneth S. Stern, director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate in New York and author of The Conflict Over the Conflict, the Israel-Palestine Campus Debate. Coming up next, the morning mayor of Atlantic City, New Jersey. Everyone's wild about Harry Hurley. Harry and I are going to have a serious conversation about the painful side of the coronavirus crisis in terms of how it's impacting lives and livelihood in the real world. And then, on the brighter side, we'll actually play a song on this talk show, breaking format, about COVID-19, performed by a rock group that has its roots in the early 1970s, and I'm now a member of the group, and we recorded it 2020 style in isolation over the internet and smartphones. I think you get a kick out of it, and I know I did, and it's going to be fun to share it with you. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is sponsored by Facebook. A new artificial intelligence breakthrough could make MRI scans significantly faster. So a scan that takes an hour today may take just minutes in the future. Faster scans would be better for patients, especially those who are in pain, young children, and others who have trouble remaining still. The new technique was developed by Fast MRI, an open source research project from NYU Langone Health and Facebook AI. Now, a first of its kind clinical study to be published in the American Journal of Retinology confirms these AI created images are just as diagnostically accurate as traditional MRIs. Additional testing is underway, and the Fast MRI team is open sourcing their code to enable others to use and build on their work. Dr. Michael P. Recht is the Lewis Marks Professor and Chair of Radiology at NYU Langone Health.
This is a significant milestone, and it shows that with AI, we can significantly improve the patient experience and provide the benefits of MRIs to many more people.
Visit fastmri.org.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. The faltering economy and the struggles facing a large cross-section of American business remain key issues in the era of COVID-19. Joining us is a radio talk show host who's not only been on the air in his town for 29 years, but actually has an avenue named after him because he certainly knows the street very well. Talker's Heavy 100 star Harry Hurley of WPG in Atlantic City. Harry, not only are you a great talk show host, you're also a great people person, and you're really plugged into the business community of your city. So here we are trying to recover from the COVID-19 economic crisis, and it certainly has affected what we call lives and livelihoods. How's the business community in your area doing in terms of recovering?
Michael, thanks for the opportunity to be on your great show. It's a mixed bag. You have some people that have been able to reinvent themselves, restaurants that always did only dine-in, never even really had any kind of takeout. Maybe you took out the rest of your meal that you didn't consume while you were there, but they weren't in the takeout business. They all had to completely redesign their business plans. It's been very challenging. Some have done very well and do hundreds of covers every night doing takeout. Some that have been around for decades can't do takeout at all. It just doesn't work with their business model. Or logistically, if you're fortunate and you have a lot of land on your property, then you can do these outdoor tents. Michael, as you know, but just for your listeners around the country, because you have so many great affiliates, we in New Jersey, we're probably locked down tighter than any state or commonwealth in the union. So we don't have indoor dining. Gyms are not open. Other things aren't happening that are happening in other areas around the country. Governor Murphy has been very, very conservative about reopening New Jersey. Casinos finally got to open, and they got to open late. Imagine, gamblers love to eat, gamble, drink, and two out of the three they basically weren't able to do inside. It's been very challenging. I know this much. Some are hanging on by their fingernails. Some are already gone, and we don't even know it. If you drive up and down the different areas, you can see signs that used to be there, a marquee sign, a storefront sign. All of a sudden, it's not there. That's your clue that they're probably not coming back. It's been tough. Some have done very well. Some have been ruined, and others are hanging on by the skin of their teeth.
One of the things that I do is I work hard, and I'm able to do that from inside. So it's not like I'm sitting home doing nothing. But when I do eventually go out occasionally, I'm shocked at how many businesses are gone. For lease signs on places that used to be furniture stores, small restaurants, retailers, jewelry stores, things of that nature. It is very shocking, and to a certain degree, it's depressing. What about the retail? What about jewelry stores? What about small convenience stores? Things of that nature. Are they gone as well?
Going, some gone. The essentials. I mean, you look at the new even greater multi billionaires that we have that have made a fortune during the pandemic. If you have something, you know the business, Michael, there's need buying and want buying. Need buying is setting records. For some reason, still toilet paper is their shortages. Hand sanitizer, they can't make enough. I think it's Lysol that puts out a million canisters a day of the different wipes. They can't make enough. Some industries are absolutely booming. Look at the prices. If you look at the prices of steak and other food, it's doubled in price. The pandemic has been boom time, and for others, it's been disastrous. And for still others, they have found a creative way to stay alive. They've managed the money that they've been able to get from the government, the way that they've been able to reinvent what they do. I'll tell you what the word you used, that it is depressing. I think that the number is 25% of young adults have actually contemplated killing themselves. A whole part of this whole pandemic that does not get the proper airing is how children are being denied the social contact that they need, and they're depressed as heck. Younger adults, middle age, this does not discriminate. That whole aspect of mental health is epidemic, probably unlike any time that we've ever seen. So if you figure, I know people that have had a restaurant for 40 years, and I won't say his name on your well-listened-to show, but he's had a restaurant for 40 years. He has not had a dime of revenue come through the door since the middle of March, and we're now doing your show, Michael, in the third week of August. It's devastating to see. The question remains, and it's unanswerable right now. How long does this go on? You know my theory. We've talked about it before on my show and your various shows. We're pandemic now. Until we are endemic and we have a vaccine, I think this, I don't like that term new norm, but this is our current reality for an unknown period of time ahead.
I think that coming to the awareness that it's an unknown period of time ahead is a healthy state of mind. I think that we went through a tremendous amount of wish thinking and a tremendous amount of, if you'll pardon the expression, delusional thinking when this first started. Remember, we were talking about, you think it'll be over in a month? You think we'll be able to have our
Michael,
convention?
Yeah,
we'll
remember, it was flattened the curve for 15 days. Nobody could have comprehended what this would be and how long this would go and that it would lower. And then all of a sudden it would come roaring back, and areas that were revered for the great job that they did suddenly had more cases than anywhere else. And it was quiet in some areas, and it was unbelievable in the Northeast, particularly, as you know, New York and New Jersey, two states you know very well. And then all of a sudden we're now experiencing fewer cases and other areas. So this is just something that until we fully understand exactly what it is, and this nonsense that people talk about herd immunity, just go out there and whoever gets it, and whoever can tolerate it and live lives, and whoever dies dies. That's not America. I'm not for shutting the country down, but I'm for taking this very, very seriously.
Harry, it sounds to me, you know, I know that you are a big supporter of Donald Trump. You've worked with him. You're friends with him. And so much of this whole thing about taking the disease seriously has been politicized. I have to salute you for approaching this in the most candid of ways. And I would imagine you're still probably on the air with you. If you talk like this, have people say to you, whoa, what's happening? You're turning on Trump? When in fact, it has nothing to do with your loyalty to Trump. How are you handling that?
By being intellectually honest and not denying what I know. You know, you can tell by my voice on your show today, Michael, I am very passionate about this. I'm passionate about my job every day. My brother-in-law, and this is very fresh with me, he is not out of the hospital for very long as I speak on your show, Michael. He spent almost 2 weeks in the hospital. He came on my show just a few days ago for the first time. He can still barely talk because just speaking makes him completely out of breath. His voice doesn't sound strong like it used to before this happened. And what I'm saying on Michael Harrison's program today, for all the people that say, I don't know a single person that has gotten COVID-19, that's my brother-in-law that I'm referring to, my wife's sister's husband. He's a great guy. He nearly died, and those were his words. He thought at one point he was going to die, and he was very, very fortunate. The remdesivir that they gave him in the hospital and some of the other therapeutics that they did took him from the brink, where his the people that know the thing you put on your finger, a pulse ox machine.
Yes.
And normal healthy people should be about 95 to 100. At one point, my brother-in-law was in the low 70s. He was spiraling unbelievably downward. And the hospital saved him. The therapeutics saved him. Super oxygenation saved him. He almost was on a ventilator, which, as you know, the percentages of coming off of a ventilator, very, very low odds. So, yes, I'm very passionate about it. And, yes, I know someone very close in our family, and his wife got it, and his daughter got it, and his son got it. The COVID-19, ladies and gentlemen, on Michael's program, for everybody that says it's not real and 99.7% don't die, what they don't tell you is maybe it is 0.3 mortality, fatality. But out of the people that survive, many people seemingly have no ill effects. We still don't know that yet. Others have had heart issues, like a Major League Baseball player who has to have surgery and will not play this year. And my brother-in-law, who doesn't know whether he will gain true quality of life lung function. He can't walk one room without wanting to pass out. COVID-19 is real.
That's one of our favorite Jersey boys, the great Harry Hurley of WPG in Atlantic City. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. And now for something completely different. Back in the old days, I used to play a group on the radio called Gun Hill Road. They had a big hit in 1973 called Back When My Hair Was Short. I went on to actually become a member of the band, and we just recorded a COVID-19 takeoff on that old catchy tune. We did it through Skype, Zoom, and even our smartphones. It's called Back When We Used to Hug.
Back when we used to hug till the corona bug took all the touching away. Nobody knew a thing about social distancing. Now we stay home and just pray.
And just pray, and just pray.
So now we've changed our way, sheltering night and day, going out weekly for food, walking to lighten the mood, trying to not come unglued, and wondering when quarantining will end, and we can hang out with others, hoping our sisters and brothers and folks are okay. When the pandemic's through, I'm gonna dance with you down crowded streets full of
streets
joy.
Full of streets full of joy.
And love that can't be destroyed. Back from the brink of the void, it's all about love.
Love.
More than ever, it's love. No lack of faith undermines us, it's the love that defines us and shows us the way. Back when we used to hug till the corona bug took all the touching away. Don't want to contact trace, just want to see your face. What mask you wearing today? How this start? Do your part and stay 6 feet away.
Some pandemic, isn't it?
Stay 6 feet away, baby.
Stay 12 feet away. How about staying a mile away?
Do your part.
Let's do all our parts. It's over, Johnny.
Masks are cool.
We'll get through it.
That's Gun Hill Road, of which I am a member, with a COVID-19 update of their 1973 hit, Back When My Hair Was Short. It's called Back When We Used to Hug. The words are written by the song's original writer, Glenn Leopold. And you can see the video on YouTube. I'm the guy with the sunglasses and the baseball cap. And that brings us to the conclusion of this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, August 17th through Friday, August 21st, 2020. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off. in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in association with Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.